the J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell, and on this week's episode, our J-League end-of-season special, Cesare Polenghi joins me to chat about Kashima's stunning win on away goals in the J1 Championship Final, and to put a bow on the top-flight season. And then Stuart Smith and John Steele take the reins to wrap up the J2 promotion playoffs and the J2-J3 playoffs. The J-Talk Podcast starts now. My guest this week watched on as Kashima claimed their 8th J1 title on Saturday night, Antlers triumphing on away goals after Mu Kanazaki's brace led them to a 2-1 win over Urawa at Saitama Stadium. Cesare Polenghi, welcome back to J-Talk. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Have you just about wrapped your head around what happened on Saturday night? It was quite the occasion, and it must have been amazing to be there.
Yeah, it actually was amazing. You know, it might have been the last, whatever you want to call it, championship final, playoff final ever in the history of Japanese football. Surely most people hope so. But, you know, if I might get straight into it, to be honest, I sort of have double feelings. In a way, it's really dumb to have, playoffs and finals after a league. But I have to say that, you know, last year I commented at the finals, and this year I watched the finals, plus I watched both last year and this year the semifinals. So overall I've seen six games, all the six games that were the two, championships in the last two seasons. And I have to say that with the exception of the game in Kashima, the other five were extremely intense and exciting. I mean, you can't deny that. So, I came back from Saitama Stadium on Saturday with, you know, in a way, the feeling I watched a great game. It was really exciting. It was real football, which, please don't get me wrong, but it's not something you see every week in Japan, because our league is very, you know, mellow overall. But on the other hand, you know, of course, there's this huge sense of injustice, you know, that the team that finished 15 points above, the first team finished 15 points above the third, and actually, you know, the third one, you know, is, you know, they are champions. I made sort of like a survey on my Twitter account. I'm actually going to pull it out and check it, but what I was asking is just like, okay, who are the real champions? You know, which team do you think are now the number one club? Is it the team that won the championship? So is it Antlers, or is it the team that won the regular season, the normal league?
Sure.
And as I pointed out, you know, like, people were really divided on that. I think it's even if you ask me, I have some troubles in answering to that question. So let me pull out the results here.
And when you tell me the result, I'll be interested, because I actually checked in on that poll this afternoon, Cesare. So it was 55-45 Kashima earlier on today. So I don't know if it's finished up at a similar.
It is finished now. Yeah. So you got it. You got the fresh. Yeah, you're correct. You got the fresher, you know, data. So you know, it's 45 reds, 55 answers. So basically, a little bit more than half stick with, you know, what the rules were set before the season. And that's fair enough, because, you know, like, when you decide to participate with these rules, you have to go with it. But also, there's a 45%. 45%, that would be 9 people out of 20. that's quite a lot. And who are saying that, you know, actually, Reds should be champions. So, okay, this, surely I do rubber Reds fans, and I sort of, you know, I feel for them. But then again, you know, hard to say. So, it was a bit of a hybrid feeling overall, but, you know, when everything is said and done, it was just like the most amazing and the most predictable outcome, especially considering how the first game is gone.
Right.
What can happen in a second round? Well, what happened is like the team that have won the title already 7 times and somehow have been able to, you know, scrape away victories, you know, like, no matter what, in the first stage, for example, or like in more recent years in the Nabisco Cup. Well, they did it again, that did, you know, like they did play as a real team. And, you know, the team that actually is one of the strongest team in Japan, or I think nobody can disagree with the fact that overall throughout the season they have been the most powerful team. I mean, like, they beat 4-0 San Fricio, they beat 4-0 Gamba. The sort of results are quite impressive. You don't see them very often in Japan. However, all they needed to do was to tie or even to lose 1-0 at home in front of a packed stadium. And I would say probably 90% of the stadium were Red supporters. And the other team supporters as well were wearing red, so no chromatic interference in there.
Right.
They still managed to lose. They went ahead. They even hit the crossbar. So if you look a little bit at you know, the story of this season again, I sort of like this multiple, you know, chokes. Is that a word? Can be in a podcast. Yeah, chokes. Yeah. In the first stage, of course, you had Frontale.
Yeah,
and you know, with two games to go, you know, they needed to win at the home of the, you know, like the weakest team in the league, and they managed to lose. So, and then in the second stage, you have the last day was spectacular. I mean, Frontale were two goals ahead. All they needed to do was to win. It would have been enough to win for them in the end.
Yeah.
And they managed to concede three after they hit the post and a crossbar, I think. At home, of course. The same day, Reds as well sort of choked because they only tied 1-1 at home with Marinos. They could have been like, they might have, you know, dropped the early, you know, the top position in the early chart. And so, you know, the final at home and in the second final at home. And then you had Frontale choking again in the semi-final at home, missing about five big chances in the second half. And then you have Reds choking again at home. I mean, if you take the last three games, the championship three games, in all three cases, the away team won, which is quite outstanding if you think about it.
Well, I was going to ask you, Cesare, you've been to all six playoff games in the course of the last two seasons, and you've not seen a home win.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, I have to congratulate to San Francisco Hiroshima, who managed to tie at home, you know, like the second final in the past year.
That's right.
That's the only game that wasn't won by the away team, mm-hmm. which is really, really surprising. I actually asked Misha Petrovic about this in the press conference after the game, just to, you know, like to bring the attention away from the result itself and try to make some generalization out of Mercy a little bit. And yeah, what he says is just in J League, they're actually no game that is really, really defined. I mean, you know, he said, like, for example, if we were Awarez, I think he said, if I remember it correct, if we were Awarez go play, say, in Niigata, well, there's no guarantee we're going to win that game. And I think what he was saying is just, he was just comparing with, you know, like, you know, let's say, like, the Premier League, or even more than that, say, La Liga or the Bundesliga, where if Real Madrid or Bayern Munich go play away at a small club, you know, like, 19 times out of 20, they're going to win. Supposedly there's this unpredictability in every, you know, every given game. But then again, you know, for some reason, me and all, you know, and several other journalists who were there for the final, we all said, you know, it wouldn't be strange at all if Anthros win this game 2-1. We really did say so.
Right.
And sure enough, it did happen. But once again, you know, like, it was exciting. It was even a bit, you know, in a way confusing, but even in a positive way, you know, it let you, you know, it was very intense. But then again, you know, more or less, you know, it went the same old way. I mean, Reds choked and Anthros won. to simplify the situation. In Europe, in South America, playing games at home is a huge advantage. Especially a final or a semi-final. I mean, it's just like the atmosphere in which the away team is forced to play is brutal. Mm-hmm. I mean, say you go play an away semi-final, you know, at Flamengo or, I don't know, at Borussia Dortmund. I mean, it's just like, you know, you really need nerves of steel in order to just, you know, keep on and playing your football. But in Japan, such thing doesn't exist. And I think that on the other hand, for many players, maybe most players, to be surrounded by your extended family, your fans, and to feel the pressure that you do have to win that game, just, you know, gives the, you know, opposite result. And, you know, it tells you a lot about, you know, the mental state of, your average Japanese football player, including the top clubs that we've seen in this championship.
Absolutely, and that, yeah, you've spoken about, obviously, several times on this podcast over the years. Cesare, we'll try and work our way through the major events in the game, just in case that any of the listeners weren't able to watch the game live or haven't seen any highlights yet. So, at kickoff, I mean, Reds, of course, held the 1-0 advantage, the away goal from the first leg last Tuesday. So Antlers' task was a simple one. A 1-0 away win wasn't going to be enough. They had to score two goals on the night to have any chance of winning the title. And, even though Reds made such a blistering start, going ahead in just the seventh minute, thanks to Shinzo Kuroki's superb volley. I mean, notwithstanding, I mean, that their task was still exactly the same at that point. And you could see that they didn't panic. And for me, Cesare, I mean, the entire tie basically hinged on Reds not being able to add a second goal in that first half hour when they were so dominant. And you mentioned hitting the bar. I mean, Yuki Muto hit the bar. He had another close-range shot smothered, I think it was, by Gen Shoji. So when Antlers realised that they'd perhaps taken Reds' best punch in the first half hour, they probably knew that they'd get chances as Reds weren't able to put them away.
Yeah, I have to agree with your analysis. It was exactly the way it went. And Reds could have eventually got a second, and at that point they might have probably won 4-0 once again.
Mm.
But they didn't. You mentioned that Yukimoto's play, that was possibly the best moment of the two finals combined. It was just like a really super play. I mean, Kuroki's goal and Kanazaki's goal, they were both good. But, if you watch them, there were acres of space around them. I mean, terrible defending in both occasions. So, and even, the two penalties were a bit, sloppy.
Mm.
What Muto did, he was really excellent. He basically built a chance all by himself. He started almost from the midfield line, or at least that's the way I remember it. It was a very impressive play. And then in the end, he even got the right shot, but he the upper face of the crossbar.
Yeah.
When, throughout the game, you got the impression throughout the first half that Reds might have scored a second and wrap it. But then again, little by little, you say they were sort of like pulling back. And then the moment and Antlers had the counterattack, even before the goal was scored, when we watched the players running up the field and Muka Nazaki completely free, it's sort of like, at least I sort of envision and I say, okay, he's going to cross, he's going to head it in or volley it in, they're going to equalize, and then in the second half, they're going to go ahead and win it.
Yeah.
That's just sort of, we sort of felt that way. And as a matter of fact, Reds had a couple of half chances in the second half. One at the very end, and another one, which I think Takagi missed. But besides those two, there was very, very little they did in the second half. So what's your take on the second 45 minutes?
Well, exactly. Well, we'll just do the equalising goal, Cesare. Of course, you mentioned it briefly there. Kanazaki completely unmarked, and you could see Shusaku Nishikawa's disgust at Ryota Moriwaki, couldn't you? Because Moriwaki just completely switched off and failed to track Kanazaki, his stooping header at the far post from Yasushi Endo's cross. And 5 minutes before half time, I mean, any time's a good time to score an equaliser, but Reds must have gone in at half time with some real doubts. Did you feel that in the stadium, the Red supporters nerves beginning to jangle at half time?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there was a real unbelievable party atmosphere. Keep in mind that Reds in the same stadium, just like a few weeks ago, they won the Nabisco Cup.
Mm.
It was an overall lucky victory, I have to say. Nonetheless, I suppose it was deserved. And so, even if it's a bit of a minor trophy, just winning that made a big difference. They had won 1-0 away. They were one goal up. It was just like, they were actually, I have to say, there were a lot of supporters wearing, scarves saying, winners with already, the shield on.
That, okay.
They were printed and sold outside the stadium before. So clearly there was the atmosphere. And then all of a sudden, when Muka Nazaki hammered in that header, it was just like, oh my God, if they score another goal, we lose everything.
Mm.
And you could really, really feel that. I mean, even in the second half, if I get into it, Panthers, they were dominating, but, you know, they were clearly a bit more in control. And as it often, you know, happens, the team with nothing to lose wins in Japan. It's just, you know, as I said, you know, like, it's so predictable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it could have been, this is really like the game or the games where it could have been a real difference if Reds had three badass foreign players in the team.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a little bit more of, you know, like, belief in themselves could have really, really, you know, carried them, you know, to, you know, like, to the title. I mean, it was so close. They won 1-0 away. They had the second final. Okay. I mean, I'm repeating myself here. It's just, it's unbelievable. And
I mean,
then, on the other hand, for anybody who knows, J League was probably the most likely, the most believable situation. So it did happen that way. Yeah.
Indeed. I mean, we know about Urawa's recent history of, you know, I hate to keep banging on about it, but I mean, it's a fact, isn't it? I mean, they haven't been able to seal the deal when it comes to claiming trophies in recent years, with the exception, of course, of this year's League Cup.
But, just keep in mind that in that League Cup, you know, with a few seconds left, you know, Gambas Goya hit the post
indeed.
And the ball rolled all over the goal line.
Yeah,
so
just
that one, they snatched by literally millimeters,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
And so it wasn't like, okay, we have it at home, you know, we just destroyed the other team we wanted. It was like they won at home. They won it, you know, in a tournament where you only need to do quarterfinal, semifinal, and final. And they won it at penalties after risking to lose it in the dying moment of the extra time. So it's not like it wasn't, you know, it's very good for them. And overall, maybe, yeah, I think it was deserved. But it wasn't a triumph, okay? It's not the sort of victory that, you know, boosts your morale. Yeah, it helps. I'm sure it helps. It's better than nothing. But it's
sure.
Not the kind of, you know, like the triumph of that you're going to, you know, tell your grandchildren about.
Well, no, of course. But, yeah, they did, at the time, get something of a monkey off their back by finally claiming that trophy.
Correct.
What is it about Kashima, Cesare? Because they hadn't won the league for 7 years. There's only three players left who played on Saturday night who were in the team in 2009, and they are, of course, Mitsuo Ogasawara, the captain, Hitoshi Sogahata, the goalkeeper, and Yasushi Endo, who was only 20 at the time and only made two appearances in the league that season. So in some respects, he doesn't even count. But how do they get it done? And we expect them to get it done on Saturday night, even though, you know, even when they haven't won the league for 7 years. I mean, these two players have title-winning experience, and so does Mu Kanazaki, of course, from Nagoya in 2010. But what is it about this place that they get it done when the pressure's at its highest and Urawa simply can't?
Well, you know, let's just very, you know, quickly go over some of the names that they have that are in the roster. Okay, you mentioned Sogahata. He's a badass. Ogasawara, he's a badass. Fansok is a badass. Mu Kanazaki is a real badass. And, you know, like, I can go on, and I think that more than half of the team are badass. And in particular, I think the guy that was the most impressive was Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like, he basically, you know, decided the game for he was the key player. He's the one who earned the key penalty. Otherwise, he would have surely scored that. And he is only 20. There's something that runs in the veins of Antlers players, the way they're selected. Maybe the fact that also, you know, they practice and they live in a place where there's basically nothing else but football. There's something that, you know, so many times throughout, you know, their history have just, like, carried them above the other teams. It's just, I don't know if you ever visited their clubhouse, their practice grounds. There's something about them which is different. The last time I went there was to interview Kayo.
Kayo, that's right, yeah.
He's badly missed, by the way. And what he told me, I trained with three or four clubs before deciding where to sign for. And the moment I just, like, started to practice with the Enters, I knew it was going to be them. I knew this was the club. This was the real club. And, you know, he's right. I mean, there's something about them, something about the way they select players, the way they, you know, their lifestyle, their, you know, there's something about them that makes them the realest club in Japan. And so it's no surprise they won so many titles. Now, if I may, you know, like, they also have this uncanny ability in scouting players. You know, like, every year they got in, you know, those two, three new young guys you never heard about, and then you see them play and say, wow, this guy should be the national team. You know, like I mentioned, you know, like Kayo and Suzuki, the two of them, but, you know, like Doi is another one. You know, of course, you know, like go a few years back, it's Shibazaki. It's just like, that, you know, what, the two center backs, you know, like Shoji and Ueda. I mean, just like it, they're really, really good at that. Imagine, okay, if they will apply the same skill in scouting abroad. If rather than just scouting high schools and universities, if they will also scout, say, players in Africa and former Yugoslavia, Eastern Europe, you know, players maybe in the rest of Asia, and they will add to their roster another three badass foreign players, that would be absolutely amazing. Amazing, and, you know, that would be like a team that, when all is considered, could really challenge for the Asian Champions League, which, you know, like, it's some, you know, a bit of a, you know, sore tooth, you know, at the moment for us. We'll talk about it, I'm sure, next year again. But so they're for real. Let's put it this way. They are for real. And with our ads, every year, I think they get a little better, a little bit more for real. But then again, this year as well, you know, well, they choked on the goal line. So, you know, what can we say there? Misha Petrovic said in a press conference, says, well, you know, when you have such a good team and, you know, like in 5 years, we never win the title. It's probably the manager's fault. And, well, he said it.
He said it, yeah. Okay.
He said it. Nonetheless, he took the job for next year as well. He said he loves his job. He loves his team. He's the best team in Japan. They play the best football and, you know, they deserve the title. They finished 15 points ahead in the regular season. What can you say?
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, just one more on Kashima. I mean, the club itself, Jezre. I mean, they hadn't won the league for 7 years, as we all know. Did you have any kind of thoughts that mystique might have gone? Because obviously they were so dominant in the 2000s decade. I mean, the three straight titles, 2007 to 2009, but then they hadn't won one since. Do you sort of think that, you know, this, you know, that golden generation where they had Koji Nakata, they had Iwamasa, they had Motoyama, etc., etc., did you feel when those sort of players kind of, you know, in dribs and drabs left the club, that it was going to be, that, you know, this, that golden run was going to be over and was going to kind of never come back?
You know, to be honest, I never felt that, because with the exception for one season, you know, overall, they've always, you know, been, you know, up there, you know, if not fighting for the title, you know, at least, you know, like ending up in some of the top positions, you know, playing in the cups. Let's put it this way. I never had the feeling that, for example, going to play a game in their stadium could have been a walk in the park. Sometimes there are some clubs that, you know, like, you know, are very strong for a period. I would say Nagoya is a good example. Okay, they've been very strong for 2-3 years, but then little by little they petered out, and you kind of feel that if you go and, you know, like in the last few seasons, go and play in Nagoya, it's not like the sort of game that would have scared you. But when you're talking about playing in Kashima, it's always like a bit, oh my gosh, we're going to go in the den of this, you know, top team. I mean, if you look at, in 2009, they won, okay, it was the 30 in a row, right?
Yeah.
After that, they finished 4th, 6th, then in 2012, they were poor, and they were 11th, and then 5th, 3rd, 5th, 1st. Through these years, they also won 3 Nabisco Cups and 1 Emperor's Cup.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, like, they've been without winning trophies only in 2013 and 2014.
And they probably won the Suruga Bank, which they probably count that as a trophy. So they've won a trophy every year.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, anyway, the 2 years when they won nothing were 5th and 3rd. And the year in which they were 11th, they did win the Nabisco Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
So the League Cup. So it's just like they never completely, you know, petered out of the scene. You know, like there's always been Nantes, they've always been up there. I mean, they are genuinely the only real big club in Japan. Now, of course, they never won the ACL, the Asian Champions League, and, you know, in my opinion, if they are a big club, that should really be their target. And in order to do that, I think what they need to do is just to, you know, expand, you know, like their borders, and just, you know, simply sign 2 or 3 very good, you know, players. They don't need to be top players, you know, super famous, super expensive, you know, those steady, you know, like, you know, hard-working players. Anybody who has played, you know, even in Europe and in South America at high levels, I'm sure will feel comfortable in an environment such as the one in Kashima. So that's, I think that's really what they need. Now, you know, one last thing I want to say about them, manager Ishii, he's been criticized. I mean, he's one of those guys who sort of, you know, like, became manager by chance, in a way. Because, you know, there's been a lot in late years. You know, either they were the youth team manager or the second, the assistant to the head coach, and, you know, then the head coach gets sacked and they get a job.
Yeah.
Well, this year he had a basically nervous breakdown when Mu Kanazaki, insulted him after a substitution. And for a week, I think he probably contemplated retiring. I mean, he was at home, he wasn't feeling good. He was probably devastated, but then he did come back. And though he always seems a bit worried and sad, that's probably his normal, facial expression, you can't deny he did a hell of a job. He's the first non-foreign manager to ever win the league with the Antlers. And, well, I think he did it in style. He really did it the Antlers way. I mean, both in the first stage and in the finals, though he didn't have maybe the strongest team, he snatched the opportunities, and when it mattered, his boys played really top level. So really kudos to him. He doesn't have any international experience basically, but it'd be really great if he could just do well in the ACL next year. I mean, to be honest, Antlers are my only hopes for a Japanese club to do well, and we'll see. But kudos to Ishii, really. He did a great job, undeniably.
Indeed. And his key move in the second league, Cesare, you've already mentioned him briefly, was that young Yuma Suzuki. We better wrap up this game with the major incident and the incident that saw Kashima win the league. Kanazaki won the ball back in midfield, and then Suzuki was sent racing clear. Tomoaki Makino finally upended him inside the box when, obviously, if Makino had his time over, he would have fouled Suzuki much higher up the pitch. But, no doubt at all about the penalty. No Reds players at all protesting the decision of the referee. And Kanazaki showed nerves of steel to blast his spot kick past Nishikawa, who guessed the right way, but simply couldn't get his hand on Kanazaki's shot. So that left Antlers 2-1 up on the evening, 2-2 on aggregate, but of course Antlers ahead on away goals with 11 minutes to go, and we mentioned briefly chances for Takagi and Muto in the second half. Cesare, I know Muto's was definitely after Kanazaki's penalty. I can't remember if Takagi's was or not, but
That was before. I think it was absolutely early in the relatively early into the second half. Yeah,
indeed. So that was a night of near misses for Yuki Muto, and he'll be kicking himself, and he'll be obviously really disappointed that he wasn't able to make one of those chances count. But what will Tomoaki Makino be thinking at the moment, Cesare, if he's not already on the beach? I'm working on his tan, of course. He's got it. He's got to take him out earlier there, doesn't he? I mean, what does he think? Does he think he can, hook the ball away from him as they're running down the pitch together?
I got the feeling, first, the ball probably went through his legs or some. So sorry, it's very hard to see from the stands, but the ball went very close to him. He had the impression that one step could have made
absolutely. The ball wouldn't have got to Suzuki in the first place. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and so in a way, it's sort of cruel that it happened to him because, I interviewed him after the game in Kashima, and you could tell he was so happy, so excited that finally, he saw it right in front of him. He left Hiroshima to go to Köln, and then rather than going back to San Frecce, he decided to sign for Reds. That means that in the last 5 years, he has seen his former teammates, from his former club, from the city where he's born, raised the J-League Shield 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
He really thought that this was his time, that, that they were the steadiest team that deserved it. And, I praised him and the rest of the team for their very convincing defensive performance in Kashima. Just I couldn't repeat it. And in the end, it's just, it was very cruel that, you know, that it had to be him, that it happened to him. But then again, I think it sort of epitomizes, it crystallizes what is that is missing in, you know, in Urawa Reds. And as much as Makino has improved, and he's a great player in, you know, J-League-wise, he's absolutely one of the best, he's deservedly in the national team, then again, you know, in one of the key moments, he let his team down. And so either he's really devastated, or maybe, as you said, he's on the beach, he's okay, and that's the reason why, you know, next year he might do the same thing again,
yeah.
You know, like in another crucial moment. So, yeah, you know, you got to feel sorry for him. One thing about the penalty, you know, when, of course, you know, it happened, there was a bit of turmoil even in the press box, so I wasn't exactly watching, you know, like the details, but I heard that actually Suzuki wanted to take him himself. And Muka Nozaki just said, no, I'm the penalty taker. I'll take care of this. But how amazing is that? It's just like, you know, when there were penalty kicks for Reds in the Nabisco Cup, and also when they were eliminated in Seoul in the ACL, the feeling you had most of the time is that the Urawa Reds players did not want to take the penalty. As a matter of fact, they missed one too many in the Emperor's Cup, and that's why they've been eliminated from that competition as well.
Indeed, yeah.
You have just like one 20-year-old who says, "I want to take it. I want to be the one who scores the winning goal." And yeah, that's typical Anthos, I would say. That just shows that they really are, you know, like a super team. At least, you know, like or maybe just say a real team, you know. But that makes them Japan wise a super team. So no surprise in the end. There's naturally, to be honest, when Muka Nozaki was kicking, it was like 110% he would have scored. Just mm-hmm. like that's it. And I actually was watching the game with Sean Carroll, who was sitting next to me mm-hmm. in the press box, and I say, what's going to happen now is that the Reds are going to have like a massive chance, like in the dying seconds of the game, and they're just going to blast it over the crossbar, which I think is what happened.
Muto, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and really, I don't mean to make fun of Urawa Reds. I think that overall, it would have been very good general if they would have won it this year. I still think they were the best team that deserved it. And also one of their players, Yoshiaki Komai, he happened to be my student when I was a history teacher at Itsumeikan Uji Kyoto. So, you know, like, I have a lot of memories of watching Komai playing since the youth team. I remember a goal he scored in extra time against Shonan Belmare, and he got injured in the act, and then he had to walk out the pitch without the shoes, and he was really upset he couldn't take the penalty in that game. I remember him when Kyoto Sanga lost the final against Tokushima Vortis, the playoff finals, and as all the Sanga players were waiting to get that sort of useless you know, silver medal or whatever there was, he was the only one not wearing the bench coat despite, you know, like the cold. It's just like a bit of a stoic guy, and I would have been really happy to see him, you know, winning the gold medal in the J-League Championship, but you probably have to wait one more year.
Yes, indeed. All right, so we mentioned that there were six playoff games in the two seasons of the two-stage system. Cesare, this game of course was the last of said
Yay!
System before the J-League reverts to a single season format.
Yeah, before their return to civilization, I must say.
Right, yeah. I mean, we shouldn't sound, you know, too snobby. I mean, there are some leagues, plenty of leagues around the world that have playoffs. I guess we were so used to
being... Yeah, you're right, like Belgium, for example.
Well, no, we were so used to
Scotland.
Being... So used to being single season after, you know, 10 years of single season, and, you know, the title went down to the final day on 8 of those years, so most of us couldn't understand the need to you know, create fake drama. But yes, after two seasons, the J-League is reverting back to 31st past the post system, and we're all the better for it.
Yeah, if I mention it, you know, you said fake drama. I know, of course, that's not, you don't mean fake, does it? But you know, the drama was there, but I think it was a bit, you know, let's call it artificial drama, okay?
All right.
Artificial drama overdose, okay? If you look at the way actually the season ended, the regular season ended, that would have been amazing if that would have been the real final. It would have been just like down to one goal as usual in J-League, until the last minute. But then again, I don't know. I think that because anyway, the Japanese like to see big games, and there are now rivalries, you know, some sort of like extra games, you know, you can think of something. I think in Australia you have something similar to that, right? Basically the league finishes and then you have like some extra. No, you don't? Okay, so...
Oh, well, no, there, yeah, I mean, there is a trophy for the team right. First past the post, and then they do have right. Playoffs, so it's, yeah, I mean...
That is exactly what I meant. But let me say this. This year, at least, wouldn't it be at least fair to send Urawa Reds to the Club World Cup?
Uh-huh. Yeah, well...
I mean, you know, you want to send, in my opinion, the team that deserves it the most, because you got a chance eventually to play against Real Madrid or some other, you know, big clubs from around the world. I think at least that should be decided before. Also, you know, it helps the clubs to organize the rest of the season, which is just like, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, like Anthers, that probably snow has been, you know, they surely they had the t-shirts printed out already just in case. But, you know, like the preparation they have to undergo in this next, you know, few days is just quite, you know, probably, you know, very stressful for the clubs and the people involved. So anyway, well, rest in peace. You know, championship and playoffs, and let me just remind that 95% of the supporters were against it, and the most vocal of them all were the Urawa Red supporters, who absolutely littered their terrace behind the goal with banners. There were so many banners that they were protesting against the two-stage system that they couldn't see the people there anymore. I think they probably had like something like 200 banners, something like that. And in a way... in retrospective, you do understand why they were doing that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. It's really, you know, yeah, it's really unfair, and it's just in a way, it's, you know, cynically one can, you know, laugh about it, but it's like they sort of could see that, you know, like the two stage will have, you know, brought a disaster to their beloved club, which they did, yeah.
Indeed, indeed. But yes, Kashima have triumphed. They've taken care of business when it had to be done. And yeah, while we all feel for Reds, who of course, as you said, Chizuru, were the most consistent and indeed the best team over the course of the 34-game season, well, that ultimately counts for very little, because they couldn't get it done over the two legs. And Antlers did, an eighth J1 title, as we've mentioned a couple of times already. All right, Cesare, before I let you go, if you don't mind, I will do a little bit of a speed round, if that's okay. We don't need to talk about the entire league as a whole, but I did want to get a couple of thoughts from you, because I didn't have you on towards the end of the regular season. So now that it's all said and done, could you tell me a team, or maybe a two at most, J1 teams that were pleasant surprises for you, who outperformed your expectations of them in 2016?
Okay, the first one is Urawa Reds. I really thought they would have been choking, as usually comes October, November. Instead, they managed to win the Ruvan Cup, now it's now called the League Cup.
Yep.
They got eliminated in the Emperor's Cup without some of their best players, because they were on duty with the national team, only at penalties away at Frontale. And they lost the championship by one goal. I think they had the best season, in 10 years, fair to say. So I think I would say it's really, you know, it was a positive surprise, because they're a big club. They're the club with the most fans in Japan, and you know, we do need, you know, like big strong clubs in Japan, especially to compete in the Asian Champions League, and to provide good players to the national team, good players coming from the J League. Of course, if I have to say one club that, you know, overall did much, much better than I expected, well, that's the other team from Saitama, and it's Omiya Ardija. I mean, they finished fifth. Okay, they only got 56 points, and, you know, they still did lose 8 games. But, you know, I think for them as well, it was their best season ever. And so, you know, of course, in the second stage, some of the clubs such as Vissel or maybe even Sagan Tosu had some really impressive moments. But if you look at the whole season, I think that, you know, that the two most impressive teams were the two teams from Saitama. Of course, I'm letting Antlers out, because they got the prize already. They don't need my nomination.
No, fair enough.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so conversely then, which team or teams were you most disappointed by over the course of the season?
Okay, now let me break this.
Do I need to block? No, need to block my ears?
No. I'm getting there. Don't worry. Okay,
all right.
That's for sure. I mean, I think that there were really several teams that, that disappointed me. Two clubs that I found really disappointing were the two clubs who won the, I mean, who played the final last year, Gamba Osaka and Sanfrecce Hiroshima.
Okay.
The reason why I was disappointed with them is because, you know, like, they basically let go of their best players and they didn't bring anybody instead. I mean, just like, either, you know, like, that's a problem that permeates the whole club. Because I can't believe the management can't really do something about that. Because we knew since, you know, months that Usami and Asano were leaving. But also, it's hard to believe that the supporters are not royally pissed off about that. I mean, the fact that, you know, like, anytime, you know, when a good young player leaves, is a drama. It's really terrible. The fact that the clubs cannot substitute him, it's just like makes it even, you know, it makes it much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, of course, you know, I think other clubs who, you know, overall were pretty bad were, well, Nagoya Grampus.
Sure.
I mean, they got relegated in, deservedly. I mean, just, I think they're putting Ogura both as, sporting director, I think he was, and, as, manager, you know, two positions he has never covered before in his life. Well, that was a huge risk, and it clearly didn't pay off. As soon as he left, you know, the team started to pick up, and, you know, like, they got, the, you know, like, a decent, you know, average of points per game, but that was too late, so that was, you know, pretty bad. Jubilo were extremely disappointing, especially in the second stage, where one of the worst teams, you know, like, I mean, not, I'm not just saying that they lost so many games, but also they were, their game was really poor, the defending was pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we need to spend a word for Marinos and FC Tokyo. I mean, they finished, respectively, I think, 10th and 9th, they were. I mean, these are clubs with, you know, like, big stadiums, a huge, you know, number of supporters. Those in the stadiums are quite a lot, and they're way more they should be able to earn, because they, you know, they cover to, you know, very populated area of Kanto, of the Tokyo area. And, okay, Marinos, the disappointment, I think, comes from the fact that, you know, they didn't improve at all from the past season. While FC Tokyo, I think they invested something like 6 more millions compared to last year. And last year they were 4th, and this year they were 9th.
Yeah.
And, well, a couple of days ago, let me give you a scoop here, there was like an event in which the president, Mr. Ogane, had a chance to speak to some of the supporters who booed him when he just walked on stage. And what he did say is that, you know, in the past season, Asoka finished 4th. Actually, it was a 3rd tied with Gamba Osaka. They just couldn't, you know, get into the championship because of goal difference.
Mm.
So, and it was a good season. But what Mr. Ogane said is that more than sporting results, what's important for him is the harmony within the club. And because of that, he decided to recall Joe Fuku. So, I don't know, maybe you want to comment on this, because the thing which, you know, one of the most impressive scenes this year that I've seen was when FC Tokyo played against Sagan Tosu, and after the game, the whole FC Tokyo team stood for half an hour around Massimo Ficcadenti to talk with him in the mix room. In the mix zone.
Yeah.
And and you know, I have a chance to visit Sagan Tosu 3 times this season, and to speak with the players, to speak with the staff there. And if there's a word that will, you know, define that environment, it's harmony. It's exactly, you know, that, you know, a group of people all rowing in the same direction, which is, I think, what FC Tokyo were in 2015. At least, you know, in the locker room, on the pitch. I don't know, in the offices. That's a problem that Mr. Ogane needs to solve for himself. I do wish him good luck, because I would really love to see, you know, like FC Tokyo, a team that's representing the city where I live, you know, to become a big club, not only in Japan, but also, you know, like in Asia, and why not in the world. And yeah, I know. Maybe, you know, I heard that the presidents in Tokyo usually stay 3 years. So if I'm not wrong, the next one is going to be the last one from Mr. Ogane. So who knows? Maybe 2018, some harmony coming back. We'll see.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, yeah, I don't really have much to say on that. So I will ask my final question, Cesare. Could you please I know it's very, very early, and we don't want to step on Stuart and John's toes at all. Their J2 special is coming up almost immediately. But could you please rank, Cesare, how you think Sapporo, Shimizu, and Cerezo Osaka will finish in 2017, the three promoted clubs? You don't have to tell me where exactly in the table you think they'll finish, but in what order do you think those three teams will finish in J1 in 2017?
Well, logically speaking, I mean, you know, like, if you just, like, look at the, you know, the clubs, their history, and especially even their, you know, their the number of supporters they have, the economic power they have, it should be Cerezo, Espals, and Sapporo. Which means it probably is going to be the other way around, I think. to be honest, you know, what's interesting is always, you know, I'm sure that the specialists are going to have way more interesting things to say, but we always had like a sort of like huge, huge underdog coming up in the third spot and then regularly, you know, being relegated in the following year. Mm-hmm. This year we got three sort of, you know, what would I call big clubs. Don't underestimate Sapporo because they have a huge fan base. They have a very capable Shacho. I mean, Shacho being a boss, you know, Mr. Nonomura, who is a former player and a former media person. He's very, very smart. And also they have very good sponsors. So, you know, they will definitely invest. And also they have a lot of local players. Sapporo is one of the prefecture with the most players in the whole of Japan. And if you play football in Sapporo or Hokkaido and you're good, you're going to end up at Consadole Sapporo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, I won't be surprised if all three clubs stay up next year. And, you know, I think that there are some other clubs who were in J1 this year, such as, for example, Kofu or Jubilo, that if they don't, you know, power up, you know, are way more at risk of being relegated next year. But then again, who knows what's going to happen? We don't even know if we're going to be able to watch the games on TV, are we? So.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, well, that's certainly to be determined. Yes, indeed. All right, then. Well, Cesare, it's been fantastic to get your thoughts again this week following the conclusion of the J1 season. And, of course, throughout the season, again, the fifth season of J-Talk, and it's been fantastic to get your thoughts throughout it. Cesare, thank you very much for your time, and enjoy the winter break. See you in 2017.
Thanks very much. Thanks to everybody. Thanks for listening all my rants this time and the previous ones, and very likely the future ones as well, because you're not giving up, Raph. You're going to continue this next year too, right?
That's also to be determined, Cesare. The listeners will have to listen in to the end of the podcast to get the scoop on that, but yes.
Okay, I vote yes, and also, yeah, I believe it's time to do some fundraising for you. What do you think?
Well, that wouldn't go astray, but yeah. All right, well, yeah, thanks again, Cesare. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much for doing this for 5 years, and surely for the sixth.
All right, then. So my thanks again to Cesare Palenghi. I now turn the reins over to Stuart and John for their final J2 special of the season, and I'll be back later to wrap up the podcast.
Hello and welcome to part two of the J-Talk podcast, where we focus on the second and third tiers of the Japanese game. My name's Stuart Smith, and I'm pleased to be joined by J2 Kanto Bites, Mr. John Steele. John, how you doing, buddy?
Stuart, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. I've just, as we've just been talking about, I had the flu last week. You've been busy, so it's good to get the band back together because we've got a little bit of stuff to go through, it sounds like.
I think we're kind of going to wrap up and put a big bow on the Christmas present that was the J2 and J3 playoffs were concluded over the weekend. So, yeah, let's see what we made of those.
Absolutely. Yes, so the J2 playoff final took place on Sunday at Kincho Stadium in Osaka between Cerezo Osaka and Fagiano Okayama. Just to relay how those teams got there, Fagiano caused quite the upset when they went to the Alwyn Stadium and beat third-placed Matsumoto Yamaga with a Shingo Akamine goal in the fourth minute of additional time at the end of the game. That sealed a 2-1 win for visiting Okayama, while Seretse Osaka drew with Kansai rivals Kyoto Sanga at Kincho Stadium, and those two results saw the teams lock horns in the playoff final on a very, very rainy day in the central Japanese city. John, just a quick question on how those teams got there. Were you surprised at the makeup of this playoff final?
I think there's been a certain inevitability about Seretse Osaka getting to the final. So I wasn't surprised that A, they got past Kyoto, and then B, they did it by sort of grinding out a draw, which the way that the playoff format works, the higher ranked team and the league standings from the regular season just needs to draw the semi-final to advance. So yeah, I wasn't surprised to see Seretse there, but obviously the situation in the Matsumoto Okayama game was truly incredible. Even the scenes of like the steam rising off the away end in the rain is very very evocative, I think, and especially because Okayama's form had been very poor going into the playoffs themselves. I just assumed it would kind of be a foregone conclusion, but yeah, Okayama scored first. But then I still wasn't sure they were going to do it, and obviously Paulinho levelled things up with only about 50 minutes left to play, and you thought, well, that draw will be enough to see Matsumoto through. But then either they threw it away, or Okayama snatched it, however you want to play the describe the narrative. But there was a truly incredible finish, and good for Okayama. I think they weren't overawed by the task in hand. They knew they had to win the game, and they by hook or by crook they managed to do it. And that's I think that's what playoff games are all about, really. They should, and they usually do favour the brave. So it's good to see their adventurous play being rewarded, I think. What about you? Were you a bit shocked? I believe you off air you told me you predicted completely the opposite. So you were.
What, off air, on air? I predicted. Yeah, I did. I thought Matsumoto Yamaga would play Kyoto in the final. So, but regular listeners to the pod would do well just to ignore my predictions. And if you're a gambling person, if you go the opposite of what I say, you won't go far wrong, I don't think. But yeah, I was surprised, particularly with Okayama, like you said, their form going in to the playoff semi-final was pretty average, shall we say. But yeah, they got the job done, and they earned their place in the final on Sunday. One thing that was a real shame for Okayama on this day was top scorer Yuki Oshitani missed out on this game through having the flu, which I can't help but think is just, it must have been a horrible, horrible feeling, not just having the flu, which is, it isn't very nice, as we all know, but just missing your team's most important game, possibly in the history. I mean, just missing out because of a virus that you know you're going to be better from in a few days. And I think that really affected the way that Okayama played in this game. I think the conditions also affected the way Okayama and Seretse played to a certain extent, because for those of you that didn't watch the game, it was played in almost monsoon-style rains, and it was not really a day for your neat kind of passing football that Seretse like to play from time to time. And Okayama can play when Yuki Oshitani plays up front for them. So it's a real shame for Oshitani to miss out on this game. But it was 0-0 at halftime. A fairly, I wouldn't say turgid first half, but it had its moments. Sosa, the Seretse's Brazilian midfielder, I think was determined to shoot from almost anywhere that he got the ball, knowing that any kind of wet bounce off the turf or any dodgy deflection could wrong foot the keeper. He was on a one-man shooting crusade through the first half. But it got to half-time at 0-0, and as you just explained, John, with the playoff rules, the higher-placed team only needed to avoid defeat to go, to win the tie and to achieve promotion. And Seretse, having finished fourth, were firmly in the driving seat. in the second half, it was a little bit of a different story. I think Okayama came out a little bit quicker at the start of the second half. They had a couple of good chances, and Sarasota's goalkeeper, Kim Jong-hyun, made a good save low down from a header. Just before Saritza ended up taking the lead through Shohei Kiyohara, his very scrappy close-range goal put the hosts 1-0 up. And from that point, John, did you ever feel that Okayama would have the necessary firepower to get those two goals back?
Truthfully, no. I thought they had more possession high up the pitch than I would have expected. I think that was perhaps a deliberate ploy on the part of Serets or Osaka to let them have the ball and just try and kind of pack the midfield and the defensive lines and make it hard for them to get through. Like you mentioned, without having Oshitani, they're kind of denied that that option of a kind of maybe a ball over the top for someone quick to chase that they used effectively on the breakaway against Matsumoto in the semi-final. So I was surprised at how much possession Okayama had, and I don't think it was beyond the realms of possibility that they would have got one goal back and made it a tie. But no, I didn't really see Seretso from that point losing the game. I think, to be fair to Seretso, they're much maligned on this podcast, because I don't think whenever we've watched them, I'm speaking for you a little bit here as well, sorry, but whenever we've watched them, they've not been particularly impressive when we bear in mind the resources available and the squad that's there. But they've been the kings of good enough this season. They made it into fourth place in the playoffs and made sure they got a home game. They drew that home game to make sure they got to the final, and just by the virtue of that one goal on Sunday, that was good enough to kind of clinch promotion for them. So I think we have to say, in a sort of triumph of minimalism for the coach, Mr. Okamura, we have to say hats off and congratulations, even if at times watching them, and I think for the players as well, it kind of seemed like physically to just be a bit of a grind for them. There are some players in there who really need a bit more freedom to express themselves, I feel. Maybe they'll get that next season. But no, I didn't really see the game. I didn't really see the game slipping away from Osaka once they were 1-0 up.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. Like you said, Okayama had a lot of the ball, but they didn't. I don't remember too many other saves that Saritza's goalkeeper had to make. And I think the best chance in the remainder of the game fell to Hotaru Yamaguchi when he went through one-on-one, but Nakabayashi saved his shot as the game went into injury time. So Seretso end up winning the game 1-0. They'll be in J1 next year. They'll be in Osaka Derby, which I'm sure will be something to look forward to in Osaka. But there wasn't a lot of time for Kiyoshi Okuma to really celebrate his win in that game, because today, we're recording this on Monday, it's been confirmed that ex-Sagan Tosu manager and Ulsan Hyundai manager Yun Jung Hwan, I've probably butchered that pronunciation, but he'll be in charge of Seretso's return season in J1. You said before Seretso have been much maligned in their time in J2, and possibly that's partly because of the manager. He's a bit of an uninspiring character at the best of times. Do you think even after gaining promotion, it's the right decision to dispense with his services and go for someone with a bit more pizzazz about him?
Yeah, I think so. I believe it's all fairly amicable because Okuma is going to be the general manager or director of football.
He's moved upstairs in football parlance.
Yeah, so I wonder if there's always part of, I mean, this coaching change, I've been reading about this on Twitter for at least 3 months, maybe longer. It's one of the worst kept secrets in the J League, and there are quite a few of those. There's some competition, but yeah, and that always seemed like it was on the cards that John Quine would come in, and I think it makes sense. He's proven at Sagan Tosu to have what it takes to be very competitive with a small market team at the top end of J1. I think he surprised everyone with how his teams played how his team played when he was Saugantossi manager. So he's got a track record that means if he's available and he wants to manage your team, I think you have to make space for him. So it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. I'm not really sure what Okumar brings to the party, particularly like you mentioned. I'm not sure I'd want him as a director of football in my organisation. But Yoon Jong-hwan, I mean, we know that the curse of the playoff team is that they always finish bottom of J1 the following season. So with kind of the weight of history against you, you'd want every chance of avoiding that similar fate. And I think Yoon Jong-hwan gives you a better chance of staying up than Mr. Okumar. So I would have made the same decision, I think. I saw today that they've also released a veteran forward, KG Tamada. He won't be at the Saints for next season, so he could be an interesting pickup for a J2 team. And perhaps he's still got enough in the legs to be a good pickup for someone else in J2. So it's interesting that they're already making some moves with their transfers as well.
Yeah, it's been quite a busy day in the pink half of Osaka, because there's been a lot of rumours about the aforementioned Korean goalkeeper Kim Jin-hyun, who is apparently a target for K-League side FC Seoul, but with a new Korean manager coming into the club, you'd think it might give him a good chance to stay. Just looking at Saratsoa's options for next year, where they have, well, for J2 anyway, they have a reasonably star-studded lineup. You've got, obviously, national team player Hotaru Yamaguchi, you've got Yoichiro Kakitani, Kenyu Sugimoto is still there. What do you think they need to, well, let's just say, avoid relegation next year?
It's a million-dollar question, isn't it? Possibly quite literally. But I think when I looked at, let's compare them with Fukuoka, because they are the team that won the playoffs last year and then continued the curse, finished 18th, came straight back down. When I looked at Fukuoka's J1 squad at the start of this season, I looked at how many J1 quality players they actually had in the team.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to probably catch some heat from Navy Blue Wasp for this, so just brace yourself. And I'm not going after Fukuoka for any reason other than the most recent example. But Kosuke Nakamura, the goalkeeper who was on loan from Kashiwa Reysol, he was one of the J1 quality players who obviously got them promoted and then wasn't there, because he went back to Kashiwa to be their first choice. And I think you could make a case for maybe saying Hisashi Jogo is a J1 quality player. But apart from that, I didn't see they had enough quality in the squad to have a good chance of staying up. So they went into their J1 campaign with arguably one out-and-out J1 quality player, in my view. Saratsu Osaka will have an embarrassment of riches in that regard if they can hold on to the players that you've already mentioned, and I'm sure they're going to add a couple more, if not many more. Wouldn't be surprising to see Union rage perhaps Saugantossi and try and bring in some players that he's familiar with who are still there. You kind of look at how many J1 level players are actually going to be in the squad, and then you kind of base their survival chances on that. But arguing against myself, the last time Saratsu Osaka were in J1, they had so many J1 level players that we all predicted they'd win the league.
Yes.
And they promptly got relegated. So I think it's going to be a Jeff United situation where there's going to be, or maybe Nagoya from last season, where there's going to be no question marks about the quality of the players in terms of ability.
Mm.
But I do think they have a lot to prove in terms of collectively as a club. Maybe the attitude of the players was pretty awful last time they were in J1 collectively.
Mm.
They lacked bottle, they lacked guts when it got tough, and I've even seen that they faltered many, many times in J2 last year,
mm-hmm.
or this year if we're speaking about 2016. So I really think I think Yoon is probably a good coach to kind of engender that kind of fighting spirit and gutsy approach. They're simply going to have to be better than last time they were in J1, because they were in trouble for months and months and just never really showed any kind of fight to get out of it last time they were in a relegation battle in J1. So I think it's not just the quality of players that get brought in or remain, but what kind of personalities they have.
Mm.
I think that's going to be really, really important for them next year. So it will be about, I honestly think whether they stay up or not next year will be based on what the dressing room is like in terms of the fight rather than ability, because I think they're going to go into the season with probably a mid-table standard squad, if not higher.
Mm.
Don't know, what do you think? Maybe that's a bit harsh, I don't know.
I think the reason I said what do they need to avoid relegation is because I think that's what they've got to aim for. I don't think they can set their sights too high. I know their supporters probably think they're a big club, and just to have them back as in J1 as a brand name club, and all that entails, I think there could be people who think they're going to win a stage then, but it's not going to happen, is it? Some people might think that they end up in the top 8 or top 6 or whatever, but I think they'll have it all on to finish above the relegation zone. Yeah, I think they need to re-sign Sosa. I think been really impressed with him. If you're talking about fight and guts and characters in that team, then he would be the one that springs to mind. I think if they can keep him and Yamaguchi together, then that's a pretty good base to go from in the midfield.
I think Sosa is also, for want of a better word, quite streetwise. Did you see the incident where he had a header on goal and then pretended to be injured in the Ok episode, asking the Seretse players were asking Okayama to like put the ball out so that he could have treatment on a non-existent injury.
Just having a rest.
Yeah, I wouldn't have kicked the ball out if I was an Okayama player, and I was pleased that they didn't, because I thought that was rank play acting. Very, very poor. He's got to improve on that, I think, for next season.
Yeah, I think, yeah. He won't be alone in doing that in J1 next year, though.
I'm not even against the play acting as much as just bad play acting. Must do better,
yeah. Yeah, I think if they keep the goalkeeper, Kim Jin-hyun, and I think if they keep Sosa, they've obviously got money to burn, so they're going to go out and buy some good players, I think. And with the new coach in charge, he's obviously done good things at Sagan Tosu before, so it wouldn't surprise me if he was the coach to break the playoff curse. It's not going to be easy, but if any team can do it with this set of circumstances, then I think Seretse Osaka will be able to do it.
I think when I cast my mind back to his Tosu team, I do think of like the hard running, hard pressing kind of never say die attitude. So if he can replicate maybe 80% of that, but his starting point is a much more talented squad, then maybe they could. They could do good things. I think that the most interesting scenario is if they lose. What's the statistic? Is it if you lose the first 5 J1 games, you're always relegated? Is that something like that? Or
if it's not right, it sounds right.
Yeah, there's some kind of curse about like something that happens over the first 5 games. Obviously, Steve Barm
will know that. Yeah,
but I'm actually hoping as a neutral. I don't really mind if Seretse get relegated or not, but I hope they have a bad start, because then you'll really get to see what that group of players is made of, I think. Like I said, there's huge question marks over there, mental strength, mental toughness from the last sort of 3 seasons, really.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how they would cope with. I think if they have a good start, they'll be absolutely fine. So that as a neutral, that's quite boring, so... I just hope they struggle at first, just to see how they turn that ship around.
Yeah, it'll be it's one of the many interesting storylines for next year, because obviously the Osaka Derby will be back next year, as will the Shizuoka Derby with Espoirs and Jubilo Iwata as well. So losing a couple of the big names from J2, but hey, that's what we're here for, right?
I think, I might be jumping the gun a bit, Stuart. I don't know if this has been officially confirmed, but a lot of rumours are that the J2 won't have these promotion playoffs from next season. You read anything similar about that?
No, I haven't, actually.
Okay, so I might be off base with this, but as a scoop, I think the the idea is that as well as J1 kind of reverting to the single stage format, they're actually going to bring back the promotion relegation playoff.
Ah,
J1, yes. J2.
Ah, so, sorry, yeah, I had actually heard that. I thought you meant just scrapping the playoffs altogether.
As far as I know, they're not, that's not 100% official yet, but for anyone that doesn't remember or is new, I think that would mean that the bottom two teams in J1 would be automatically relegated, and the top two teams in J2 would be automatically promoted, but then there'd be a two-legged playoff between the third bottom J1 team and the third top J2 team over two legs, and whoever won that two-legged tie would be in J1 for the following season. So actually the same format as we have in the J2 and J3 playoff, their promotion relegation playoff now. So it'd be interesting to see. I was a bit sad when I heard that. I've enjoyed the playoffs kind of stretching down to sixth place. In J2 as a fan, as a neutral.
It keeps the season open a little bit longer, I suppose.
I guess the flip side would be, as we mentioned, the team that wins those playoffs is always relegated.
Yeah.
So perhaps it's not good. It's not good for the league. It's not good for J1 to kind of have like a just add a whipping boy every year. We'll see.
Yeah, we will see, and hopefully, Sarasa won't prove to be next year's whipping boys. Just before we move off Saratoga Osaka, we just want to give a nod to them for their tribute to their former striker Kempes, who passed away in the tragic plane crash in Colombia earlier on this week. They entered the field of play all wearing Saratoga shirts with number 9 Kempes on the back, and I think Yoichiro Kakitani, I think he lifted the playoff trophy whilst wearing the Kempes shirt. It was a really nice touch from Saratoga, and at the end of a really horrendous week, it was a touching move to see them pay tribute to one of their former players. Moving on. So obviously Saratoga will be in J1 next year. Fagiano Okuyama will stay in J2. At the bottom end of J2 and the top end of J3, we had the second leg of the J2-J3 playoff. And after taking a one-goal advantage into the second leg, Soegun Kanazawa made sure of their place in J2 next year by beating Tochigi SC 2-0 in a game that was played in Toyama for reasons that not escaping me, but escaping my comprehension more concisely. Goals in either half, won a penalty, made sure that Kanazawa will stay in J2, Tochigi will spend another year in J3. John, I know you didn't get to see all of this game, but just your general views on kind of Zweig and Kanazawa being in J2 again next year?
Yeah, well, I don't think we can have any arguments that they comprehensively won the playoff. 3-0 aggregate score kind of is above suspicion, if you like. So fair play to them for doing that. I noticed the player Keiya Nakami, who scored both goals yesterday, is actually from Tochigi, so he might want to keep a low profile when he goes home.
Ouch.
He goes home for his Christmas and New Year holidays. I think Tochigi just fell a little bit short. Not to blow my own trumpet, but I did mention the last time I was on that they might at this point Tochigi were top of the J3 table and 3 points clear of Oita. I kind of flagged up that they might lose their last home game against Nagano, and then be pipped to the title by Oita, which is actually exactly what came to pass. And I think psychologically it was just too much for them to get over that hurdle. A little bit like with Matsumoto, perhaps, you know, having that hangover of kind of having automatic promotion snatched away at the top of J2. So yeah, fair play to Kanazawa. I think they've been pretty awful all season, obviously. which is why they were second bottom. But they had a chance to redeem themselves. They had to take it, and over the two legs, the 180 minutes, I think they grabbed it fairly emphatically. So well done to them, and I hope they come back stronger next season. Very strange build up to this game, Stuart, which you've alluded to already, but the fact that Kanazawa couldn't use their own stadium for, like, arguably the most important game in their history, because the pitch had already in the process of being relayed, which meant that obviously the pitch couldn't be used for this match. A bizarre scheduling, a good example of how in Japan quite often the stadiums are actually not the property of the clubs, but they're owned by the local sort of municipality, the local government, and they kind of do with them as they see fit. But surely, first of all, that work should have been scheduled for when the J-League games definitely wouldn't happen. And if the work was scheduled for when there was a potential class, it should have been moving. Kanazawa were kind of arsing around at the tail end of the pitch and embarrassing themselves for months before this game. So with one phone call, you could have said, listen, we might need to play one more game on this pitch. So I think we've talked before at length about how it's almost a lot of hard work goes into actually getting the lower league clubs moving in the J-League. It's not an easy balance of balancing a municipal stadium and everyone is. But I think somebody somewhere really took their eye off the ball on this one. And I'm almost relieved that Kanazawa won, because it would have been a shame if they'd had that, not had the home stadium advantage, if that had worked against them in some ways, especially considering they had to play at Toyama, which is kind of a local rival.
Exactly, yeah.
They're not very popular. Also, before their first leg was even played, they announced that the manager, Morishita, wouldn't be having his contract renewed for next season. And I just think the timing of that was kind of off. You know, I mean, you've got the team preparing for the two-legged match, which is going to decide which division they're in next season. Whether they're in a proper league or they're in a kind of, let's be honest, sort of Frankenstein's monster with some B teams, and God knows what ideas they've got cooked up for J3 for next season. I dread to think. But yeah, then you're announcing, oh, by the way, we're not playing at our own stadium. Playing at the stadium of our nearest professional rival, and the manager who's going to be in charge of the team for these two super important games, we're going to fire him at the final whistle of the second one. And I believe it or not, I've never run a professional football club, but I'd like to think that I would have avoided those PR gaffes.
Very J-League indeed. I think for the manager, yeah, I agree it was odd timing. I mean, my impression is that it's kind of difficult to keep those things secret, but they should have gone all out to keep it until after the final whistle of the second leg. They should have waited until then to make that announcement, I think. About the pitch, I have quite strong feelings on this. I feel that Swig and Kanazawa should be punished, because I think it's, you said someone took their eye off the ball. With regards to organisation, there isn't kind of much worse taking your eye off the ball than what happened with that. I don't know if they own that stadium. My guess is that they don't, because it's a prefectural sports park.
No, they don't.
They don't. But someone should have had the wherewithal to say, hey, look, at the moment we're in 22nd place. There's a high likelihood that we might have to play one extra game 1 week after the season's finished, or 2 weeks after the season's finished, or whatever. Is it possible to stop the relayment of the pitch until we've finished our season? They have severe winters up in Kanazawa. I don't know if it started snowing already or whatever up there, but I feel very strongly that Kanazawa should get some kind of reprimand. I'm not sure what kind of punishment you could give them. Like, I'm not talking about kind of docking points or whatever, but teams need to know that the organisation of the league and the validity of the competition has to take precedence. Like, they can't have these situations. They just can't. And I feel that they should be they should be brought before the J League and have some kind of punishment handed down to them. John, to wrap up this year in J2, I didn't say anything about this before the pod, so I'm just springing this on you right now. But
Jesus.
No, it's not a quiz. Don't worry. It's a wish. If you could wish for anything for J2 next year, what would it be? I'll go first, just to give you a little bit of an idea, a hint on how to approach this. My wish for J2 next year is that the scheduling, especially for games that are between teams that are relatively local, I'm being a bit selfish here, thinking about Gifu, Nagoya, Matsumoto, etc. I hope those are scheduled fairly so that the away teams can take as many fans as possible to those games. I'm not going to be happy if, say, a potential Nagoya versus Gifu in Gifu, if that's scheduled on a Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, I'm going to be very, very happy, because they're just losing a huge number of fans on that kind of local derby kind of vibe. And my wish for next year is that scheduling is taken into account when scheduling these kind of local derbies. That's what I wish.
I think that's very sensible. I would probably have gone for something similar. On the scheduling point, I would like to see, and I think I read some kind of rumblings that this might actually be happening, but I'm splitting the games more evenly over Saturday and Sunday. Might be a good thing, because it's been kind of the standard pattern over the last certainly 3 or 4 years. It's been that J1 plays on Saturday, and J2 plays on Sunday, regardless of, that's like a kind of clean break, and it's pretty obvious that Sunday is the less popular slot, because when J1 is off for an international break or whatever, J2 always moves to Saturday, which reinforces the idea that it's the second class league. Well, it is the second class league, it's Division 2, but I would like the fans of J2 teams to be treated with this similar respect that the fans of J1 teams are treated, in the sense that maybe it would be nice to have an even split of Saturday or Sunday and Sunday games in a season. You know, if you've got 21 home games in your season, maybe at least 10 of them are on Saturday.
Mm.
Because in my case in point, when I started doing the blog and the Twitter account, I work on half the Saturdays in a year.
Mm.
So that was one of the reasons that I ended up watching the J2 games, was because I knew that I would be able to cherry pick exactly which ones, you know. I mean, so I'm actually arguing for something which would be worse for me. but it would be,
because you're that kind of guy. You're a selfless guy.
It would be better for the league.
Mm.
And that's, you know, I'm just an all-round gregarious, you know, just an all-round nice guy. It would also perhaps prevent me from wasting a lot of money watching these games. The other one, and this is long-term, so you asked for a wish for next season, so I keep it within that frame. I would like at least 3 teams that are in J2 now, I would like them to announce concrete plans for a new soccer-specific stadium.
Nice.
Because I actually, as a nerd, I kind of went through the list of how many J2 teams have actually got a soccer-specific stadium. It's too low.
Mm.
It's way, way too low.
And we've lost one of them in Kitakyushu.
We've lost one in Kitakyushu. We've lost there at Osaka
and
well.
Shimizu.
Yeah, that's right. They've abandoned us. So I would like some inroads to be made in that regard. I do. I'm not a complete romantic. I understand this is very expensive, and it's not within the means of all clubs, but. I would like to see every club. I think the J League should make it a requirement that clubs have to make some kind of effort to gauge support for a football in the stadium,
or
even if they've just got a link on their homepage, which is like a petition to sign.
Yeah,
a place for fans to donate if they want to. I don't care what form that takes, but it should be I would make it a licensing requirement, to be honest, for J2 teams. Maybe not now, but it is kind of working towards that. It's like you've got to show me evidence. Either you've got plans for a soccer-specific stadium at some point, or you've got cold, hard evidence as to why it would, as to why you can't have one.
Yeah.
And even if you look at the one, I mean, Vanrade Hachinohe have just opened this Daihatsu Stadium, which is it's like a Lego set, really.
It's, yeah.
It's very cute and tiny, but I'm not talking about, I'm not expecting to see like a Suita soccer stadium for every J2 team. That's not what I'm talking about. Fans in J2, they're charged similar prices to fans in J1. They're actually charged similar prices to a lot of European top leagues.
Yeah.
To watch the games. I accept that the standard of football on the pitch is very exciting, but often not that great. So I think fans are getting the shaft in terms of the quality of the product. But they're also getting it, which I think is far worse, is the facilities are often pretty poor. And I'm going to start taking my son to games in the next probably 3 to 4 years. And I honestly will pick and choose the games where he can watch them in a good environment, and being close to the pitch and actually being able to see properly what's going on. That'll inform my decision, because I'm not a supporter of a particular team, so I've got that luxury, I guess. But if you do support, for example, Machida, you're kind of stuck with they've done their best with the new main stand, but you know, you're watching football in an athletic stadium.
Yeah.
And it's suboptimal, you know.
Yes.
Is the bottom line. So I would like to see the clubs be nudged or perhaps shoved in the direction of making actual solid commitments to doing that, because I think after 10 years of traipsing around these stadiums, I actually think that's probably critical to developing the game for fans here.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I completely agree with all of that, actually, as a seasoned J2 watcher. Yeah, we could do with seats closer to the pitch, I dare say. And on that kind of wish and a prayer for 2017, I think we should wrap up our 2016 pod. What do you think, John?
I think we should. I think there've been a few managerial comings and goings we should discuss, but I think perhaps I might even break my blog silence and write about those for the Japan the J League Register. I can't even say the name. J League Register site at some point. So yeah, maybe look out for some kind of managerial comings and goings piece in the future. Yeah,
that sounds like a good thing. I'm going to have to rest my voice. I think it's just about to go. I think I've run out of strepsils as well. So John, this year it's been great. Thank you very much. I'm pretty sure I'll meet you in the same place next year for more rubbish predictions from me, more self-promoting and self-congratulating predictions from you, and
That's right.
We should all be set to go in 2017, right?
Yeah, I think we've reached the point where I get like this every season. I'm like, I need a break now.
Yes.
But I can promise you that I think I'm going to go to one of the Emperor's Cup quarterfinals on December the 24th. And by
Merry
that
Christmas.
Point, I'll be like, I need the league games to start now. So I need a break, but 3 months is a bit too long. So yeah, hope the time passes quickly, and we'll be back and banging in February, late February.
Absolutely. And on behalf of John and myself, I'd like to say a big thank you to Ben, who goes through the whole rigmarole of setting up this podcast and recording the podcast on a weekly basis. He does a phenomenal job with it, and I'm pretty sure for all the listeners, we want to wish him a happy break. I don't know if this is the last podcast of the year. I might be prematurely retiring this podcast in 2016, but even if it's not, he deserves a cyber high five for all the hard work that he puts in. And thank you to all the listeners who listen and send all the questions and who are part of the J2 community on Twitter and on the J League Register blog. And it's really good to know that there's an audience for this kind of stuff. So on behalf of John and myself, thank you for listening this year, and we hopefully will have you back as listeners again next year. Until then, enjoy the winter, and we'll see you here next year.
And that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast, and indeed for the 2016 J-League season. My thanks again this week to Cesare Palenghi, Stuart Smith and John Steele, and of course to you for listening wherever you are. I'd also like to thank all of the guests we had on this season, a grand total of 15, and while it's rude, I know, to mention some but not all, in particular Stuart and John did an amazing job with their J2 specials throughout the season, and Sam Robson and Alan Gibson did a lot of heavy lifting on the pod this year, often helping out on short notice. To them and everybody else who's featured this year, thanks so much. I quite literally couldn't do this without you all. Thanks also to all of you who contributed questions via Twitter and helped to spread the word about the podcast. Cesare asked me about the future of J-Talk. Well, it's somewhat up in the air, as my wife is pregnant with our second child, and our future FC Tokyo winger is due at the end of March. So things will be a bit hectic on the home front, and I can't commit to a sixth season of the pod at the moment, but hopefully we'll speak again down the road. Thanks again for listening to the J-Talk podcast this week and throughout the season. Bye for now.